We will now call upon our brother Jim to lead us in a consideration of the life of Abimelech as a type of the history and destiny of the papacy. Brother Jim.
Thanks, Brother Bruce. Well, brothers and sisters and young people, I emerged from work this evening to be confronted by a news placard that said something like, "Threat of a new world oil crisis." I didn't bother to patronise the news because I think you know what it's all about. The fact of the matter is that the simmering situation in the Persian Gulf is threatening the flow of oil from that place, which is currently sustaining some of the Western economies, particularly the European economies. And though America is at the moment quite capable of surviving on its own oil supplies and reserves, once that area is shut off to the world, then there will be a pinch of oil supplies in this world that will make it impossible for there to be continued economic growth, as slow as that may be. And I believe that Yahweh has provided himself with the madmen that now control Iran, the successors of Muhammad, great imposture, about which we've just sung. He's provided himself with those men in order to draw the superpowers, and in fact all nations, into that area, that there might be some sort of sorting out of the positions of the nations. That there might be, of course, the acquisition of a king of the north by Russia taking Iran and the area of Iraq, and a king of the south by Britain and America perhaps being forced to enter into the area of Oman, Saudi Arabia and so on. I believe that we can look forward to some very dramatic events very shortly, brothers and sisters, in that area. But the most important thing for you and me is this, that any pinching of the world's oil supplies is going to precipitate the long-awaited recession. And we believe this time it won't be a recession. This time it's going to be a massive depression. Because, you see, there are so many factors now working together towards that, that it will be impossible for the nations to withstand the pressures. The debt bomb, for instance, is about to explode. It won't be very long before conditions are such that anything in the way of a crisis will set that bomb off. And once that goes, the whole lot goes. And before that goes, you and I go. It's as simple as that. Before all that slides away and the Laodicean period of the Ecclesia comes to an end, you and I must go. Before it becomes impossible for men to buy and sell and plant and build like they're doing today, as never before, you and I have got to go. So you see, brothers and sisters, we're living on borrowed time. The world is living on borrowed money. And it can't go on living like that for very long. And you and I haven't got very long either to put our lives in order, that we might be prepared for the day of our judgment. It's not very far away now. I'm confident about that. Brothers and sisters, if time should go on, that it goes on only that you and I might get our house in order, our individual house and our ecclesia. That's the only reason that Yahweh could withstand the evil that is now current in this world. You look around you, you see what I see, you probably see more. Brethren and sisters, it's horrendous what is happening in this world. It is absolutely grotesque. But Yahweh has held his hand. He has been long-suffering. And the apostle says that that's for your sake and for mine. How long can he wait? Well, he won't wait much longer. Hence it becomes very important for us, brothers and sisters, to use every opportunity, and this is just one of them, that we might be prepared for that great day. You recall in our last class that we spoke about the dramatic events of Armageddon as they are portrayed in the record of Judges chapter 7. And then we went very quickly into Judges chapter 8 to show how that Gideon's work involved the regathering of the Jews from all parts of the earth. Tonight we're going to take a step back. Not really a step back, although we're going to be talking about some history. We're going to take a step back and have a look at the position of the life of Abimelech in the overall type of Judges. It's obviously beholden upon me to demonstrate to you beyond all dispute that the life of Abimelech was indeed intended to be a type. It is possible to use the elastic band method, of course, in types and to stretch them beyond their intended limits. I'm aware of that and I'm sensitive to it. Hence, you've been given a piece of paper this evening which tries to do what I'm going to do this evening, God willing, and that is to tell you some details about the life of this man. If I don't happen to finish in time, and that's probably likely, then you'll still have it in written form to consider. And if you consider it long enough and hard enough, you will come to the conclusion that I've come to, that here in the ninth chapter of Judges, we have an absolutely amazing record which sets forth comprehensively the history and the destiny of the papacy. Why should it be so? Well, just reflect upon these few things for a minute before we enter into the life of Abimelech. I want to ask you just a few questions. Why the story of Abimelech? After all, he was not a divinely appointed judge. In this book bears the name, the Book of Judges. He was not a judge. Why, therefore, do we have the story of his life? Surely there were many others, like Abimelech, who rose up and tried to gain prominence in the nation. There must have been other stories, dramatic stories, that could have been told in that 300-odd years of history. But Yahweh chose to devote a chapter to the life of the son of Gideon, named Abimelech. He was a self-appointed king. In fact, brothers and sisters, we are often, of course, wont to say that Saul was the first king of Israel. Well, he was. He was the first divinely appointed king of Israel. But there was a king before him. Abimelech was the first king of Israel. He was a self-appointed king. And you know what? In the Bible, there was another self-appointed king who was the first. The first king of the Bible was Nimrod. And he, in fact, is set forth in Judges, in Genesis chapter 10 and 11, I should say, as the first pope. Abimelech, the first king, self-appointed, albeit of Israel, is set forth in this record also as a type of the pope, as we shall see. The second question is this. Why such an extensive record? Judges chapter 9, as you can see, has 57 verses in it. The story really begins in chapter 8, verse 29. So you might say there are 60-odd verses in this book devoted to the life of Abimelech. We saw in the study of Othniel you had 5 or 6 verses. And yet Othniel's life was obviously a type of our Lord Jesus Christ. Why so much detail? Would the Spirit not have been better served by just giving us a few verses of summary of what happened to Abimelech? Well, it doesn't do that, and there's a reason for that. The third question is this. Why all the seemingly needless detail of treachery, confusion, and carnage? Do we want to know about that? Well, merely as a historical record, it is interesting without being critical. But brethren and sisters, it's there for a reason. Fourth question. Why should the great man Gideon's achievements be marred by the actions of his foolish and ambitious son? Why should this tragic record reflect upon the life of that great man Gideon with all its bitterness and confusion and evil? Well, it's there for a reason. Because you see, it fits beautifully into the overall pattern of this book. And as you'll see on the front page of the notes which you were given this evening, there is this diagram which sets out the coverage of the types in the book of Judges. We saw in the life of Othniel, there was a coverage of the first and second advents of our Lord Jesus Christ, and perhaps the links that join those two advents together. In the work of Ehud, we saw the atonement spelled out in great detail, and then we were taken to the end of the millennium, to the time when all flesh would be subdued. In the story of Deborah and Barak, we saw how that was an unfolding of the principles of Genesis 3:15. It had to do with the first and second advents of our Lord. And of course, in the life of Gideon, we have seen a beautiful and comprehensive type of the work of our Lord Jesus Christ. When we come, God willing, to the life of Jephthah in a fortnight's time, if we are still here, we're going to see just how a remarkable type that man is of our Lord Jesus Christ in a different aspect of his work. Here we will see, brethren and sisters, in the life of Jephthah, the work of the Lord in relation to Israel. We'll see him purifying first of all the house of Judah, then regathering the Ephraimites, Israel, from the four winds of the earth. And we'll see him purify that house upon the basis of the principles of the atonement. It's a marvellous story. Well, of course, it was fitting. But in all of that, Yahweh should give us something about the great power that would impose itself upon firstly his ecclesia and then upon the world and would dominate human history for so long and would make one final mad attempt to dominate the world through the agency of the Russians, that it might gain its oft-stated and oft-repeated desire to dominate all humankind. Why shouldn't Yahweh do it? Well, he did it, as you will see. And here in the life of Abimelech, as you can see, we have a period that spans what we call the Dark Ages, and that's why in Judges chapter 9 you will look in vain for the name Yahweh. You'll look in vain for the divine name, but you'll find a lot of reference about Elohim, because Yahweh could only work in that period of time through the Elohim, as he did, to protect here and there the witnesses who witnessed against that great system. But he was absent from it, so he leaves his name out of this chapter. We're going to see as we proceed just how comprehensive this type is. But as I said, it's not up to you to accept that. It's up to me to prove it. So we're going to do something unusual. We're going to look at the first section of our notes about the rise of the papacy in some detail. And tonight, I'm going to read extensively from these notes and then add points here and there. And then we're going to go to the end of the story and the demise of the papacy as it's recorded at the end of chapter 9. And I would hope, by the time we've done that, brothers and sisters, you will probably see that we do in fact have before us a type, a divinely intended type, of the rise and fall of the papacy. And if you can accept that, then we can go on to the section entitled The History of Papal Ascendancy, which is the middle section of the study, if we've got time, and you will see that the details exactly fit the history of the papacy when it was ascendant over humankind. Now then, the story really begins, of course, back in chapter 8. You may remember, those of you who were here, that we completed our class last time around by referring very briefly to the request of Israel that Gideon become their monarch and establish a perpetual dynasty. He declined because he said in verse 23, Yahweh shall rule over you. And of course, Yahweh was Israel's king. But along comes a man who sets himself up as king of Israel, who appoints himself with the help of the men of Shechem, brethren and sisters, and he takes over the position of Yahweh in that nation. We're going to see just how appropriate that is, the development of the papacy. In verse 24 through to verse 27, we have a rather tragic account, really, although it doesn't reflect terribly upon Gideon. It was certainly a mistake. For after the victory over the Midianites, he requested of Israel they do one thing for him. He says to them, give me all your earrings of gold that you took from your prey. And he used, of course, those earrings to make an ephod. An ephod, of course, was the shoulder piece of the priest's garments upon which was placed the other pieces of that of his attire, the breastplate, etc. And of course the ephod, we know, was used in relationship to communication with God. David was wont to say to Abiathar the priest in the wilderness, bring hither the ephod, because it was seen as the means whereby men could communicate with Yahweh. And the reason that Gideon requests the golden earrings has to do with hearing, is that he had enjoyed such wonderful communication with his God through the chapters that we've considered, that he wanted to memorialize his association with Yahweh. So he created this golden ephod, which to him stood for the communication that comes with God through tried faith. But of course Israel was a nation that was given to idolatry. And it wasn't very long before they went a-whoring, as verse 27 tells us, after the ephod which Gideon had made. He hadn't intended it to be an object of worship, no more than Moses in making, for instance, a brazen serpent had intended that Israel should worship the serpent. But they were doing that in the days of Hezekiah. So Hezekiah destroyed it. Here he made a golden ephod, not to resemble anything like the gods of the nations, but to memorialise the great things that had occurred in his life. It was a mistake, because it brought about a false worship. It gave them an excuse to turn away to an external form of worship, as you can see there in the notes. Under the heading, The Rise of the Papacy, in the middle section of the notes now, of course, Judges 8, verse 27, you will see that in the lighter type we have stated the words, Gideon's house ensnared by an external form of worship. Then we have some bold type following that. The bold type builds upon the facts stated, that is, it gives you what we believe to be the type. And we say there, the Roman church grew out of a Judaistic apostasy in Christ's house. Now in Eureka Volume 1, Dr. Thomas points out in pages 230 to 234 that the Roman Catholic system developed out of Judaism. That is, it arose out of Jewish external forms of worship. Because, of course, the first century ecclesia was turned away to apostasy in due time by the influence of the Judaizers. And, of course, their influence had to do with external forms of worship. They taught that men ought to be circumcised and so on. And so the doctor points out that after about 280 odd years, that produced the development of the Roman Catholic Church. It began in the first century ecclesia, and Israel was responsible for it. And here we have in Israel a man, Gideon, who we've seen to be a type of Christ, who established the ecclesia upon firm and strong foundations. But there were those in Israel who developed an external form of worship into a dreadful apostasy that had as its head a man who regarded himself as a father king, as we shall see in a moment. Those of you who are familiar with Zechariah chapter 5 and the flight of the storks will know that Zechariah 5 makes the same point, that the Roman Catholic apostasy grew out of Judaism. I know that sounds a bit difficult for those who are not familiar with it, but brothers and sisters, it's a fact. And if you want to extend that particular point for yourself, then I would suggest that you read Eureka Volume 1 and those four or five pages that we've noted. And you will see, as the doctor unravels the argument, just how it occurred. So here we have that occurring in Israel. There's an external form of worship. They're worshipping an ephod for the wrong reason. And it develops an apostasy. In verse 30, we read that Gideon had 70 sons of his body begotten, for he had many wives. It just so happens, of course, that the number 70 is the number of the Gentiles. And the work of Gideon, being a type of the work of Christ, brought about the extension of the gospel message to all nations. All the Gentiles were to hear about him. So this man had 70 sons. And of course, they spread their influence around. In verse 31, we read that he had another son. For his concubine that was in Shechem, she also bare him a son, whose name he called Abimelech. You read that verse carefully, brothers and sisters, and it tells you something. Something very important. Because back in verse 27, we are told that Gideon's city was Ophrah, some distance away from Shechem. We don't know how far, but it was some distance away. Gideon lived in Ophrah, but verse 31 tells us that he had a concubine that was in Shechem. We don't know that she was in Shechem when Abimelech was conceived. It was quite possible, it's quite likely, that she was in Gideon's house when Abimelech was conceived, but for some reason she became estranged from Gideon's house and went back to live in her own city of Shechem. Concubines were like wives. They weren't actually wives. The word means to be soft. I don't need really to extend the idea of what they were used for. Concubinage was simply an additional wife for a man, and even though he would manifest toward her the same responsibilities as he would towards his wives, she didn't quite have the status that they did. So here was a woman that had been in Gideon's house, but now she was estranged from it, and in her estrangement, she brought forth a son who was probably conceived in Gideon's house. So you see, we state in the notes that Abimelech was born outside wedlock to a woman estranged from his house, from Gideon's house. And of course we know, brothers and sisters, that the man of sin was born out of fornication by the apostate ecclesia, which is described in Revelation 12 as a woman being great with child and who was clothed with the sun. And out of that woman was developed the papacy. We'll see how the fact of being clothed with the sun has relationship to the story here in a moment, because the sun, of course, has relationship to government. And the ecclesia, the apostate ecclesia, we'll call it the church which had developed out of the true ecclesia, had been invested with political authority and brought forth a son. 280 years after the ascension of Christ, in the year 313 AD, the exact period of human gestation in years, there came forth a man-child from whom was to develop ultimately the papacy. Brothers and sisters, that's why I believe that this man was given the name Abimelech. End of verse 31. Because Abimelech means father, king. Father, king. And papacy, the title papacy, as you can see from the notes, signifies papal government. Papa, or pope, means father. And the pope is regarded by those who support him, and many others who don't, he's still acknowledged to be a ruling father. He's a father king. Hence, when he comes to this country, he's given virtually a royal welcome. All the forces and resources of the state are rolled out to welcome him as a head of state, because he's a father king. Here he is, Abimelech. We go on and we see that the mystery of iniquity was at work in the ecclesia in verse 33. For Gideon died. And as soon as Gideon was dead, or in the type, as soon as Christ was taken into heaven, the mystery of iniquity began its evil work that was to arrive later on, 280 years later on, with the emergence of a system that was to develop the papacy. And Israel, we read, turned again and went a-whoring after Balaam and made Baal-Berith, the Lord of the Covenant, their God. So we come, brothers and sisters, to chapter 9 and verse 1. Where we read that Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem unto his mother's brethren and communed with them and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying. So Abimelech is described here in verse 1 of this chapter as the son, the word is Ben, which means a family builder. He was the family builder of who? Jerubbaal. Now why do you think the record calls Gideon Jerubbaal? Well, of course, Gideon means hewer down. Jerubbaal means a contender against Baal. So here was a man who was allegedly, in his own eyes at least, he was the family builder of the contender against Baal. Now, Baal, of course, you could summarise in one word. It was paganism. It was the worship of the elements, sun, moon, stars, rain, thunder, lightning. You name it. There were lords many and Baals many in the world. That was paganism. So here was a man who was purportedly the contender against paganism. We're going to find him embracing paganism. He was not. such a contender against it. Hence, brethren and sisters, we state in the notes that Catholicism contended against paganism only to usurp its political power. But then, of course, it adopted pagan doctrines into its creed. Under the guidance of men like Constantine, the Catholic Church acquired pagan doctrines until it was paganism in Christian garb. It contended against paganism, or so it appeared, but it wasn't Jerubbaal. It was not the family builder of Jerubbaal. We go on in verse 2 and 3 to read this. Speak, I pray you, he says, in the ears of all the men of Shechem, whether it is better for you either that all the sons of Jerubbaal, which are 70 persons, reign over you, or that one reign over you. Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh. And his mother's brethren spake of him in the ears of all the men of Shechem all these words. And their hearts inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. Abimelech's house, brethren and sisters, made an alliance with the men. The word men in verse 2 is the word Baal, which means, of course, possessor or owner. He made an alliance with the owners of Shechem that they might join with him to overthrow Gideon's house, his father's house. And so it was that the apostate church made an alliance with the state to assume control of the religious world, and to destroy the true ecclesia. Now you might say to me, well, you're jumping to conclusions here. How can you say that Abimelech's alliance with the men of Shechem has got anything to do with the Roman Church's alliance with the state? Well, just pause for a second. You'll see that we've got some quotations in the notes, and that we make the point that the name Shechem means to shoulder a burden. And Shechem is particularly related to shouldering the burden of government. You join me in the 1st of Kings chapter 12. You can perhaps slip your notes in Judges 9. In the 1st of Kings chapter 12, of course, we have the division of the kingdom upon the death of Solomon. And you'll remember, of course, that both David and Solomon had reigned in Jerusalem. And one would imagine that if you had to choose one place in the whole land where you would appoint the new king, it would be Jerusalem. But it wasn't. In 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 1, we read, and Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel came to Shechem to make him king. They're going to make him king, and they're going to go back to Jerusalem and sit upon David's throne. Why Shechem? Because it was the place where responsibility was bestowed upon people. It had particular relationship to giving people political responsibility. You come with me to Isaiah 9 while we're on the same point. It's important for me to establish this point in your minds because I'm making an assertion. And the assertion is that Abimelech's alliance with the men of Shechem has to do with a type. And that type is about the alliance between church and state. We've seen that Abimelech represents a system, an apostate system, but he represents a father king. He now makes an alliance with the owners, the possessors of Shechem. Isaiah 9, verse 4. For thou hast broken the yoke of his burden, this is about Russia, and the staff of his shoulder, the word is Shechem, the rod of his oppressor, as in the day of Midian. Have a look at verse 6. For unto us a child is born, and unto us a son is given, he is the true Messiah. And the government shall be upon his Shechem. Is there any doubt in your mind, brothers and sisters, that Shechem has to do with political power? Government? I could go on and on in the Old Testament to demonstrate that where you meet Shechem, you're talking about the bestowal of responsibility, and in particular, political responsibility, as well as religious. So as we go back to Judges chapter 9, in verses 2 and 3, We see Abimelech making this alliance with the men, the possessors of Shechem. What for? That he might persecute the true ecclesia. And Abimelech gave them an opportunity to weigh up their future. When he said to them in verse 2, would it be better for you to have one ruling over you or many? Because you see, he was building upon the fact that all Israel wanted the house of Gideon to rule over them, even though he refused to do so. Wouldn't it be preferable to have one instead of 70? That was his incentive to them. And of course they responded positively to that. And so it was true, as the notes point out, under verses 2 and 3, that with the support of the church, the divided rulership of the Roman Empire was united under the man-child Constantine. So also the church itself moved from laity, that is, rule amongst the ordinary members, to clergy, bishops, and so on, to papacy. Took a while, but they got there in the end. And the father king ultimately emerged in the apostate church. One ruler or many? They've only got one. Have a look at verse 4 of Judges 9. You'll notice at the end of verse 3 that Abimelech was called our brother. And as the notes point out, the church fought alongside Constantine as his brethren in arms. And in verse 4 we read that they gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-Berith. Here's a man who's supposed to be contending against Baal. He gets 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-Berith, the very centre of paganism. Wherewith Abimelech hired vain and light persons, says the record of verse 4, which followed him. Rotherham translates that they were loose and unstable men. And as the notes point out, he cements the alliance by being given 70 pieces of silver. Silver, we know, is the symbol for redemption. And of course, when you had the power to take silver from those who worshipped, who saw their need for redemption, it established your religious authority. So Israel brought along the half shekel of the sanctuary to acknowledge the authority of Yahweh and their own poverty before him, their need of redemption. So here we've got Abimelech being given, brethren and sisters, the symbol of religious authority out of the house of Baal-Berith. And so it was, as your notes will point out, that the Roman emperors gave the church its religious authority because of its agreement, its covenant, to adopt and to uphold pagan doctrines. And the church dipped in to the house of Baal-Berith, and they brought out all their doctrines, trinities, immortal souls, devils, and all sorts of things. They got all of them, brethren and sisters, from the house of Baal-Berith. What did he do with it? Well, he used it. He hired loose and unstable men to support him. So the church developed a paid clergy to promote its own interests. Verse 5, and he went unto his father's house, the ecclesia, at Ophrah, and he slew his brethren, the sons of Jerubbaal, being 70 persons upon one stone, because they all stood for the same thing. And they witnessed against him, and he slew them. Notwithstanding, one escaped, named Jotham, the younger son of Jerubbaal, because he hid himself. Brethren and sisters, as the notes say, he slew all the family builders of the contender against Baal. Men who were following in the footsteps of their father, who contended against paganism in Israel. He slew all them except one. So the church persecuted to the death the true ecclesia, which witnessed against its doctrines and practices. But one escaped. There was a remnant. Jotham. His name means Yahweh is perfect,
Or Yahweh is upright. He escaped death by hiding himself. And so, for instance, the Donatists and others fled to North Africa, the distant parts of the empire, and they escaped that they might bear witness against the apostate system under very harsh and severe persecution. And many of our brethren's souls lie beneath that altar, brethren and sisters, their blood having been poured out because of the persecutions of that system. And the day is near at hand when they will have the right and the privilege of rising up to see the demise of that system which has held sway for so long in this world. Verse 6, and all the men of Shechem gathered together, and all the house of Milo, and went and made Abimelech king by the plain of the pillar that was in Shechem. He was proclaimed king by the oak of the pillar that was in Shechem. What oak? And what pillar? Well, you'll see in your notes that we have a few references there, and I want you to join me in Joshua 24, first of all, while I just remind you of what Genesis 12, verses 6 and 7 say. When Abraham first came into the land, brethren and sisters, he came to Shechem. Shechem. And it was there that Yahweh said to him, unto thy seed, Christ, have I given this land. I'll give it to him. In other words, Yahweh declared that he was going to give political authority to Abraham's seed over that land. Interesting, isn't it? So Abraham built an altar under an oak that was by Shechem. And later on, Israel were brought there by Joshua. Joshua 24. Same place, same oak. Look what he does. Joshua, of course, is the Jesus of the Old Testament. Joshua 24, verse 25. After having given them a warning about their impending apostasy, because the evidence was all already there, the mystery of iniquity was at work in Israel. He could see it. Verse 25, he said, Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and set them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem, and he wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and he took a great stone, a pillar, and he set it up there under an oak that was by the sanctuary of Yahweh. It was the sanctuary of Yahweh because Abraham had been there first. So there was the pillar established under the oak that was by Shechem. It was put there by Jesus, because of the associations of that place with the Abrahamic covenant, or what we would call in one word, the truth. And here's Abimelech being appointed king by the men of Shechem, apostate men, by the pillar of the oak. You see, Abimelech understood that he had to give his new system the imprimatur of the divine acknowledgement. He could best do that, brethren and sisters, by going to a place that was associated with the very foundations of the truth, that he might give his system a Christian guise, that he might give it ostensibly Christian origins, if I might use those words. Have a look with me at Genesis 35. Because after Abraham, another man came to the oak that was by Shechem. And this man was a type of Israel. And he perceived that the mystery of iniquity was already at work in his house. Jacob, of course. And just before he left that place, Shechem, to go to Bethel, verse 2 says, of Genesis 35, then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you and be clean and change your garments. Almost the identical words that Joshua used in Joshua 23 and 24. Put away the strange gods that are among you. Because, of course, these men, his sons and others who were with him, his servants, had just routed the city of Shechem. And they'd taken all the teraphim and the idols and the household gods and bits and pieces out of that place. So Jacob says to them, you get rid of those things. We won't have them here in this ecclesia. Have a look at verse 4. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their, look at the words in your Bible, all their earrings. We've just been reading about that in Judges chapter 8, which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. And there was a pillar there as well. Here's a man who perceived that the mystery of iniquity was already at work in his house. Not long later, as far as Yahweh's concerned, a couple of days. In his view, a couple of thousand years later, there was a flight of the storks, brothers and sisters, and the family of Jacob was taken to the place that was the centre of idolatry. They were taken lock, stock and barrel to Babylon, to the very house of Baal-berith, that they might learn to bury their idols under an oak. If only Abimelech had remembered that piece of history about the oak that was by Shechem. But of course, like the system he represents, they were ignorant of that sort of thing. And he thought that by going down to that place, he could associate himself with Abraham and with Joshua, Jesus, in such a way that everybody would accept that he was the father king of Israel. I think you can begin to see, can't you, the development of the papacy and all that? Well, having established that, let's just finish off this first section quickly. The next passage quoted in your notes, 9 verse 6, should be 9 verse 7. So we'll read verse 7. When they told it to Jotham, he went and stood in the top of Mount Gerizim. I'm back in Judges 9, of course, now. He stood at the top of Mount Gerizim, and he lifted up his voice and cried and said unto them, hearken unto me, ye men of Shechem, that God may hearken unto you. In other words, he acknowledged what they wouldn't acknowledge, that Jotham had communication with Yahweh and that Abimelech and his cohorts did not. Though they thought they were establishing a system around which Israel's worship would revolve, there was no communication between Abimelech and the men of Shechem and the God of heaven. Hence he's silent about his own name in this chapter. Well then, that verse tells us that Jotham went to the Mount of Blessing. You'll recall that at Shechem there were two mountains, and between those two mountains there was a shoulder, and the city was built on that shoulder. There was Mount Gerizim, and there was Mount Ebal. Ebal to the north, as there is Ebal to the north of Israel today, Gerizim to the south, toward the city of peace. Gerizim, brothers and sisters, was the Mount of Blessing. It was the place where Israel shouted forth the blessings of Yahweh upon that nation if they would obey. And this man, Yahweh is upright, stands upon that mountain, and he witnesses against a system that was just being developed in Israel and which had now seen the emergence of a father king. So we say in the notes that Jotham witnessed against the men of Shechem from this position. The remnant of the true ecclesia assumed a position of divine blessing to witness against Rome's apostate system. Quickly we come down, we pass over the parable of Jotham, which is interesting but not perhaps particularly relevant to our subject tonight. We come down to verse 16. He rounds off his parable this way, by a rebuke and a curse. Now therefore, if ye have done truly and sincerely in that ye have made Abimelech king, and if ye have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house, and have done unto him according to the deserving of his hands, and then in the parenthesis he adds these words, for my father fought for you, and adventured his life far, and delivered you out of the hand of Midian, and ye are risen up against my father's house this day, and have slain his son 70 persons upon one stone, and have made Abimelech the son of his maidservant king over the men of Shechem, because he is your brother. If ye then have dealt truly and sincerely with Jeroboam and with his house this day, then rejoice ye in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. We'll just hold it there for a minute. He makes a very significant point in verse 17, and it's this, brethren and sisters, that Gideon had adventured his life far for Israel. The word adventured means to throw down or to cast away. So Rotherham translates it, he cast his soul away from him. The Interlinear Bible puts it, He cast aside his life. He gave his life for the nation. So we say in the notes, Christ laid down his life for his brethren, but many corrupted the truth and sought another way. And then in verse 20 we read that Jotham concludes by saying, but if not, let fire come down, come from out from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem, and let the house and the house of Millo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from the house of Millo and devour Abimelech. So there was to be mutual slaughter. There was to be a breakdown of the alliance between church and state. And of course we know that the history of the Roman Empire and then of the Holy Roman Empire is dotted with events just like that, where there was a dispute, constant warfare between church and state as one vied to take control, political control of their empire against the other. As we say in the notes, the alliance between church and state was fragile, often leading to bitter struggle. Then we see in verse 21 that Jotham ran away and fled and went to Beer and dwelt there for fear of Abimelech his brother. So the remnant of the true ecclesia found refuge in what the Apocalypse calls the wilderness. And they went to the far-flung reaches of the empire that they might escape from the persecution. And in thus doing, of course, they spread the gospel message far and wide and continued their witness against the system. Now you can turn to the back page of your notes and we'll come to the final section, the destruction of the papacy, which brings us to verse 50 of this chapter. I might just introduce this by saying that prior to verse 50 there has been conflict between the men of Shechem, another man called Gael, the son of Ebed, who makes an alliance with the men of Shechem, and with Abimelech and those who followed him. This had culminated in the overthrow of Shechem itself. It was overturned, and the men of the Tower of Shechem were destroyed. But then in verse 50, Abimelech seems to do a very unusual thing. The record says that he went to Thebes and encamped against Thebes and took it. Now Thebes doesn't make an appearance in the record before this time. In fact, you only find the name in the Old Testament three times. Two of them are in this chapter. So you see, for some unknown reason, strange reason, Abimelech decided to attack another city, which had, maybe, revolted against him. We don't know. We're not told those details. But we do know this, brethren and sisters, that he's about to perish. The end of his system has come. And he attacks a city called Whiteness. That's the meaning of Thebes. Whiteness. And here is a city that stands in this record as a type of that city, which is going to become the centre of this world's entire life. The city of Whiteness. Brethren and sisters, it's not hard to see as you go on that what we've got here in verse 50 onwards is a type of the attack against the city of Jerusalem of an alliance between the papacy and the communists to form what we call Nebuchadnezzar's image. That massive image with Babylon at the top, the thinking power is Babylon, with its two legs, the Roman Empire, eastern and western legs, one religious and one political, in alliance for a work of dominating the world by capturing the city of Jerusalem. They come against the city of Whiteness. He's got a problem. He does well for a while, verse 51. There was a strong tower within the city, and thither fled all the men, the word is Enosh, all the ordinary mortal men of that city, typical of the men of Israel who will fight to the last man. All the men and women and all they of the city went into that strong tower and shut it to them and gat them up to the top of the tower. And that's the picture that Zechariah 14 portrays, isn't it? Thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee, and I will draw all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished. and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, but the other half won't. And those who remain there will be fighting vigorously and desperately against Russia. And then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations as he fought in the day of battle. That's the story. And so verse 52 says that Abimelech came unto the tower, and he fought against it, and went hard unto the door of the tower to burn it with fire. And a certain woman cast a piece of a millstone upon Abimelech's head, and all two brake his skull. Then he called hastily unto the young man his armour-bearer, and said unto him, draw thy sword and slay me, that the men say not of me, a woman slew him. And his young man thrust him through, and he died. And when the men, Ish, the mighty men of Israel, saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed every man unto his place. And so Abimelech, the father king, and his system comes to an end by the casting of an upper millstone from the height of that tower in the city of Jerusalem, smashing his skull. And there's going to be a crashing of the serpent's head. And the political manifestation of the serpent there in that image power is going to be crushed by a woman who comes from a high place. Not hard to see what we've got here is a type of the overthrow of the power of the papacy in alliance with Russia by Christ and the saints. Let's just read the notes for verse 53 to 55. Abimelech was fatally wounded by an upper millstone cast by a woman and slain by his armour bearer. You notice that I say there, an upper millstone. That's because in verse 53, where it says that she cast a piece of a millstone, it doesn't mean a piece of the millstone. A millstone, of course, had two sections to it. There was an upper millstone and a lower millstone. The upper millstone was somewhat like, it was a wheel. In the middle of that wheel, there was a hole through which you poured the grain. The bottom part of the millstone had a beveled edge, which sat over a lower millstone. And the upper millstone was the one that did the moving. And it went round and round and crushed, of course, the grain between those two stones. The word in the Hebrew, therefore, millstone, is rekeb. And it has reference on a few occasions in the Old Testament to an upper millstone. But the reason the word rekeb is used is because that millstone used to move, just like a wheel, in particular, the wheel of a chariot. Hence the word rekeb is used far more times of a chariot than it is of a millstone. The translations have this sort of thing. For instance, Rotherham translates it simply an upper millstone, but the Interlinear Bible translates it a riding millstone, because it was the stone that moved like a chariot wheel. And 114 times in the Old Testament, that is the way the word is translated. Chariot. The chariots of God are 20,000, said Psalm 68, in the context of the crushing of a man's skull. And Armageddon is going to see the emergence from the heights of Sinai and over the heights of the Mount of Olives of a woman that will be dressed in white robes, as it were, as we shall see in a moment. And she, in the company of her husband, will burst forth upon the power of Gog in alliance with the papacy, and all two break their skull. You join me, if you would, in Revelation chapter 18. The 18th chapter of the Apocalypse records the demise of the papal system in these terms, in verse 21. And a mighty angel. That's the multitudinous Christ, brethren and sisters. That's you and me there in verse 21. That's the saints. They're the woman of chapter 19, verse 7. Let us be glad and rejoice, says that verse, and give honour to him. For the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife hath made herself ready. There she is. She's spoken of in company with her husband as a mighty angel in chapter 18, verse 21. And look what it says. A mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea of nations, saying, thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all. And why was all this done? Have a look at verse 24. For in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that was slain upon the earth, Gideon's 70 sons, the remnant of the true ecclesia. Have a look at chapter 19. For instance, take verses 2 to 4. For true and righteous are his judgments, for he hath judged the great whore, which did corrupt the earth with her fornication, and avenged the blood of his servants at her hand. And again they said, Alleluia. And her smoke rose up forever and ever. And the 24 elders and the 4 living creatures, there's the saints again, both in their warlike aspect and their priestly aspect. Here they are, and they cry, Alleluia. Praise be to Yahweh, brothers and sisters, because then will have come the judgment of that awful system. And chapter 19 describes those who are involved, who follow the mighty angel who rides upon a white horse in chapter 19, verse 11. There's our Lord Jesus Christ, and he's in the company of those who follow him. And he's named the King of Kings. King of Kings? We're just looking at the demise of a system that was headed up by a father king. I haven't got time to say much more than that. You can follow that for yourself. But when you come back to Judges chapter 9, this is how the chapter ends. Verse 56, thus Elohim, the divine agency through mighty ones, rendered the wickedness of Abimelech, which he did unto his father in slaying his 70 brethren. And all the evil the men of Shechem did God render upon their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham the son of Jerubbaal, and the prayers of Yahweh's faithful servants were finally answered. Vengeance is mine, I will repay. So there was the demise of that system. And the father king, and all he stood for, was dead. And all his adherents were dispersed, and they were picked off one by one, as they will be very shortly with the demise of the papacy. Brothers and sisters, I hope by now that we've established that we are really talking about a divinely intended type. With what little time is left, and there isn't much, let's have a look at some of the history. We'll take it from verse 22. The history of the papacy in its ascendancy. Verse 22 of Judges chapter 9 says that when Abimelech had reigned 3 years over Israel, then God sent an evil spirit, Elohim sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. That's exactly what happened when the papacy was ascendant. Dispute arose between church and state, which resulted in violent struggles. And the church, which gained its power from the state, tried to rule the state, because, of course, ultimately the papacy was given its political power. And ultimately, that dispute brought about the dreadful events of the years 1572 to 1685, when God's two witnesses were ultimately destroyed and killed and laid in the street of that great city for 105 years until the French Revolution. And what does that verse say? When Abimelech had reigned 3 years over Israel, you spell that out, 3 years of days, if you've got 3 times 360, which is the number of days in a Jewish year, and that's 1,080 years. Have a read of your notes. After 1,080 years, or 3 years of days, spelled out in typical terms, of papal rule, the church rose against two witnesses. The revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685 was 1,077 years after the decree of Phocas, which gave the Pope his political authority. We've seen the men of Shechem give Abimelech his political authority at the pillar by the oak in Shechem. 3 years after that, Abimelech turns upon the men of Shechem and destroys them, because there are people in that city who are witnessing against him. We've seen the religious witness, and there was a political witness, as we shall see in a moment. Now, brethren and sisters, it's curious, isn't it, that it should be 3 years. And that brings us from the year 608 and 610 after Christ, when the decree of Phocas gave the Pope his political authority, right down to the revocation of the Edict of Nantes and the death of the two witnesses. Well, what happened? Just briefly, the story. Verse 23 tells us about the evil spirit between the men of Shechem and Abimelech. Verse 26 brings to bear a record of another man who rose up against Abimelech. His name was Gaal. Gaal means loathing. He was the son of Ebed, servant. Some suggest the name should be Eber, to cross over into opposition. This man Gaal, with his brethren, came and went over to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. But not all the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. Because as you read that record, and if you've done that before you came tonight, you'll know the story. The ruler of the city of Shechem, a man named Zebul, though he appeared to give his support to Gaal, the son of Ebed, was really in secret alliance with Abimelech. He'd never ceased to support Abimelech. You know, when you go through the history of the papal system, that's exactly what happened. As the time neared for the witnesses who had ceased to witness effectively to be killed. Now, you know, I think Revelation chapter 11 points out that God raised up against the papal system two witnesses. There was a political witness, that is those who witnessed against the ascendancy of the papacy, saying the Pope shouldn't have political authority to rule over them. And there was the religious witness, that is those who wanted the freedom to worship and to believe what they wanted to believe and to worship, instead of having that dictated to them by the Pope. And of course, amongst that religious community who witnessed against the papacy, there was somewhere to be found the true ecclesia, who were witnessing for different reasons. Brethren and sisters, those two witnesses did a very effective job to harass the papacy for nearly the full length of its history. But when their witness grew dim, as the doctor points out in Eureka, the time for them to be killed came. And the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day in 1572 set in motion a succession of events which culminated in the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. And in 1685, all witnessing against the papacy in France and elsewhere was expunged. And that's exactly what Abimelech does. This man Gaal here, in verse 26, represents the religious witness. Why? His name means loathing, detest, hence to reject something. And he was the son of the servant. He came out of a servant. Here was one who grew up out of the true ecclesia. You might say he represents the Protestant movement that had its roots originally back in the true ecclesia in its origin. Grew up out of that system. And those witnesses who loathed Rome's dogmas and rule crossed over and joined with political witnesses to fight against papal dominion. What did they do? Well, have a look at verse 27. We've seen that the men of Shechem, who've now changed their allegiance, represented the political witness. Gaal represents the religious witness. Verse 27 says that in their alliance they went out into the fields and they gathered their vineyards and they trod the grapes and they made merry and they went into the house of their God and they did eat and drink and cursed Abimelech. Protestantism, as we say in the notes, repudiated Catholicism but produced a creed full of the wine of Babylon as the basis of their new covenant. All the doctrines of the Roman Church were simply transferred into their creed. yet they witnessed against that system. They were drunk with the wine of Babylon. Hence we read in verses 28 and 29 the drunken words of this man Gaal. Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, "Who is Abimelech? And who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is not he the son of Jerubbaal and Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem? Why should we serve him?" That's a drunken, you might say it's almost a drunken song. Here is a man who's infected by the intoxicating influence of the new wine that they've just been drinking. And in that statement there, brothers and sisters, he gets his facts wrong, as men who are drunk usually do. You see, he says at the end of verse 28, "Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem? Why should we serve him?" He's talking about Abimelech. He doesn't even know who Abimelech really came from. He thinks, in his ignorance, that Abimelech, the son of Gideon, was actually a descendant of Hamor, the father of the original Shechem, which you've got to go right back to Genesis 34 to find all about. Well, of course, Hamor was a Hivite. He had no relationship to Israel at all. Gideon was a son of Jacob. So this man didn't even know the origins of the house of Gideon. You see, that's exactly the state of Protestantism, isn't it? They protest against the church, but they're infected with its wine. They're intoxicated. They don't know what they're talking about. They're drunk. And the papacy, of course, has fought against them, as Abimelech was about to fight against these men. Now, we haven't got time to do all that history. You can read your notes. And you'll see how it follows through. And I believe it fits the pattern exactly. And those of you who are familiar with Eureka will see, as those details unfold, that the same pattern as occurs in the Apocalypse occurs here in Judges chapter 9. I want you to come with me to verse 46, and we'll finish off the class for this evening. Because you see, this battle which Abimelech fought against Gaal and the men of Shechem, who were now in alliance with him, but who were being undermined by the ruler of the city, even as the witnesses were undermined by the feudal lords of Europe who were in alliance with the papacy, culminated in the overthrow of the Tower of Shechem. Verse 46 says that when all the men of the Tower of Shechem heard that, they entered into a hold of the house of the god Bereth. They retired into their fortress, brethren and sisters. And that's exactly, of course, what the Protestant church has done. As you'll see in your notes, the remnants of Protestantism, intent on securing their position of authority and influence amongst the people, banded together against Rome, but have not forsaken her pagan dogmas. Their strength is in their citadels, their massive churches, which are basically empty, and their craven adherents, people who are there, who are spiritless and cowardly, who can't see that the system they support is riddled with the wine of Babylon and will meet the same end. What will happen to them? We'll read on. It was told Abimelech in verse 47 that all the men of the Tower of Shechem were gathered together. And Abimelech gat him up to Mount Zalmon, he and all the people that were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a bough from the trees and took it and laid it on his shoulder. Shoulder? The word is Shechem. He laid it upon his shoulder and said unto the people that were with him, "What ye have seen me do, make haste and do as I have done." And all the people likewise cut down every man his bough and followed Abimelech. And they put them to the hold and set the hold on fire upon them, so that all the men of the Tower of Shechem died also, about 1,000 men and women. And very shortly, the papacy is going to have total ascendancy over what we call the Protestant churches. Not by the power of the sword, brethren and sisters, but by the power of suffocation. Because you see, green wood doesn't burn very well. It lets off a lot of smoke and fumes. Try it in your home fireplace one day and you'll find out. The neighbours will complain. And this man went up into the mountain. Look at the mountain, Mount Zalmon. That mount means a phantom or an illusion. He was deceiving the people. What did he do? He cut down a bough, the twisted bough of a tree, and he put it on his shoulder. to represent his ascendancy in government. But, brethren and sisters, cutting down a bough of a tree is just like what the Pope has done as he goes from country to country and he leans his head upon what is supposed to be a replica of the cross with the crucified Jesus hanging on it. You ever seen it in the newspapers? He leans his head against this twisted, what looks like a bough of a tree. Leans his head against it in the attitude of prayer. It's all an illusion. He's trying to represent himself as being the latter-day successor of Christ. The one who would carry the cross. The government would be upon his shoulder, and he would have power by religion if he couldn't get it by the sword. And slowly but surely, having lit the fire under the Protestant system, he's going to suffocate them. And last year, in Assisi, in the great cathedral, the Roman Catholics convened a convention of all the world's religions to pray for peace under the tutelage of none other than the Father King himself, bearing his twisted cross. It won't be long, and all protests against the Catholic Church will be silenced. He will suffocate them. If not by the sword, and he can't do that anymore, he'll do it by the power of the cross. As you've seen me do, so you do. There's the power of the cross as it's working today. And the next step, brethren and sisters, that system attacks the city of whiteness. And you and I are there, riding as the chariot of Yahweh, like an upper millstone, down upon the skull of the Father King and all he stands for. But we'll only be there, you know, if, like the bride of Christ, that certain woman, our garments are white, like the city will become.